Denmark. And maybe, I hope it's of interest to other people. I have a friend in Japan who more or less said, "You're only interested in this because you're Danish. It's not interesting at all." He thought, you know him, David, it's Yijan. He thought it was not very interesting. But I think it is. And I do think Ishimura is interesting. I think he's been somehow neglected, forgotten in recent years. He died in 1930. But in his lifetime, he was certainly very influential in Japan and one of the Japanese intellectuals who was also influential abroad because he wrote in English. And so I'd like to speak about, in a way, you could say I'm trying to read Ishimura through Karl Mannheim. And that means some of you may know Karl Mannheim is another sort of figure from quite some time ago. In 1929, he wrote a book called Ideology and Utopia, and where, for him, utopian thought is that which criticizes the existing political order and points to alternative futures, and ideology, as in Marx, is the kinds of ideas that prop up the existing order. And what I found with the reception history of this text is that it's had an interesting history from being a utopian critique of the way things were in Meiji Japan to becoming what you could call a pillar of the post-war ideological order. And again, in recent years, it's being reread and mobilized to criticize some tendencies in Japan today about nuclear power, about rearmament and the abandonment of pacifism, etc. So that's basically what this is about. Now, he's probably not a person you're that familiar with. This is what he looked like. He was born in Edo and he died in Tokyo, you say, which is the same place. But he was born before the Meiji Restoration, and he died just one imperial reign from us. He's almost our contemporary, but he was born almost in the Middle Ages. So he lived through a period of tremendous change. And he studied, just to continue with biography, at Sapporo Agricultural College, which was the precursor to Hokkaido University today. This was the technical college where teaching was in English by American teachers. So it was very much modeled on American education. And it wasn't a missionary school. These people were employed by the Japanese government, but many of them were also missionaries, which means they were not officially... The school was not a church school, but some, and especially a person called William S. Clark, who was only there for a year, but managed to convert all his students, which I think is quite impressive. And 16-year-old Ishimura was one of those. But that conversion, it wasn't without conflicts. There were conflicts between these young Japanese converts and the missionaries, which led them to found their own independent congregation. And there is this book, this is a very interesting text, in fact, I found, a person called Carl Skovgaard Pedersen, who is a Danish theologian who took a year's sabbatical. At that time, he was head of the Danish Mission Society's theological seminary, and he went to Japan for a year in 2010-2011. And one of the things, and he has a chapter on Ishimura. He spent about a week with him, interviewing him in his house, probably in English and or German. Or he was also, on his travels, he was also accompanied by a Danish missionary who spoke Japanese, but with Ishimura, they probably spoke directly with each other in English. And I think that chapter is very interesting because he compares him to Søren Kierkegaard, and Ishimura refers, and already did at that point, a lot to Kierkegaard, without really having read him or having, I think, very much of an understanding, other than thinking this is somebody who's like me. He is an anti-authoritarian, anti-ecclesiastical Christian who believes in a Christianity without churches. And Scoville Peterson also, I think this was quite, I find that remarkable for somebody who really knew very little, I think, about Japan, just arrived and said, writes in that chapter that in Japan you have Shinto, Buddhism, Confucianism. Uchimura is a very Confucian kind of Christian. That's what he wrote, that he's much more Confucian than he's Buddhist. And then later in Uchimura, after his first marriage failed, he ran away to America for 4 years and got another science degree in addition to the one he had from Sapporo at Amherst College. He worked at an institute, a charity for disabled. I hope I'm not using some incorrect term now. Mentally disabled children. Is that an acceptable term?
Yes.
And he started then studying theology at Hartford Theological Seminary, but gave up after one semester. It wasn't for him. Which is, I think, is interesting because what he is probably most remembered as is as a theologian. But that kind of theology wasn't for him. And something, I'll say this is something actually that came up with I was discussing this with my wife the other evening, and I said to her that I thought he's quite unsophisticated as a writer and thinker. And I think you can say he is, when you compare him with contemporaries like Inoue Tetsujiro or Japanese philosophers who came later after him, like Nishida, for instance, he's not. He seems sloppy, he seems ill-informed, and so, but what my wife said, which is true, I think now, that's not lack of sophistication. Remember, this was a man with two science degrees who started philosophizing. So, you know, he's actually taking a big step and doing something quite courageous and original. He didn't just stick to agronomy and he did something, you know, big. He came back to Japan and became a teacher, quite an elite teacher, at the first higher Daiichi Koto, which was, today it's been incorporated into the University of Tokyo as the School of Arts and Sciences. In those days, it was the kind of the elite feeder school into the imperial universities. So, as an educator, that is pretty much as high as it gets. Well, the next step up would be the imperial universities. But there was an incident there, which is interesting, because he kind of quite spontaneously decided during a ceremony not to bow or not to the imperial rescript on education, and he argued that he could not do so on religious grounds, that he could not recognize he could not worship the emperor. He would very gladly pay his respect, but not to worship the emperor as divine. And well, then that got him suspended, and he was in fact willing to apologize. But he was also very ill when that happened. And then this was Inoue actually wrote about it as treason. And there was a big sort of media storm about how this lecturer at this prestigious elite school had refused to bow to the emperor. And although he had changed his mind, he was ill and had decided to apologize, but didn't get to do it, so he lost his job and became an independent freelance journalist, editor, and independent lecturer. and quite still very influential, though, speaking to audiences of 500 to 1,000 people in Shinjuku every week, and writing, and also he was also one of, you could say, the earliest environmental activists. And this is part of, when we get to my text, a bit part of the background to that is that he had criticized the mining industry very strongly. The mining industry had cut down trees, and this had caused a lot of landslides, floods, and poisoned rivers, and basically made life miserable for the workers and people who lived in these areas. And he thought that this was very wrong, and this is part of the background to later what when he sees sort of what he thought he saw in Denmark was another way of actually, instead of cutting down forests, replanting depleted land where which had become infertile due to human activity, but regenerating that. So he was very influential on some of his students, who were figures like Yanaiha Tadao, Nambaru Shigeru. They both became presidents of the University of Tokyo, and say that his disciples, their influence really peaked sort of in the late 1940s, 50s. And in that way, some of those ideas that he began to articulate in the late 19th century, early 20th century, around pacifism, developmentalism, and what I would call non-colonial monarchic mercantilism, by which I mean that Japan should not have colonies, should be happy to be a small nation state that trades with the world. That, I think, is what made his ideas sort of part of, you know, become ideology, turn from utopia in their original context to ideology after August 1945. And it's generally, we can say, I think it's remarkable how, given how few Christians there are in Japan, that some figures, I think, and also how missionary education, I mean, how influential that has been and continues to be in Japan. There are so many Christian universities, but figures like Uchimura Nitobe Inazo, his contemporary, who, and together they founded a girls' school in just next to Keio in Tokyo, that's still there, and Yoshino Sakuzo, Yanaihara Nambara, I mean, they were very, very influential, and as Yanaihara Nambara, especially from 1945, as leading political scientists at University of Tokyo, were people who were consulted by the government, people who had an actual, you know, serious input into policy, public policy, and of course also political thought, which was out of all proportion to this very small number of Christians were in Japan. And then, of course, what he's most known as is as the founder of Mukyokai, non-church movement, we're speaking about morality before and kanji. I think another way you could reach this, I think that I don't think he may not have intended any ambiguity or sort of the other interpretive possibilities, but you can think of it as non-church, but you could also think of it as the church of nothingness, or as the association of those who believe in nothing, couldn't you? I mean, if you... No, David, you look skeptical. And he was also, as I said, a key figure in projecting the image of Japan abroad, because he wrote works in English which were then translated and were bestsellers in Europe in 1906, 1908, especially his work How I Became a Christian, which was translated to German, French, Danish, lots of European languages. Okay, this is sort of
what this is one of the 1913
edition, what it looks like,
and as you can see, it has a title in English there as The Story of How Faith and Forestry Saved the Country. So that was
an edited transcript of a lecture he gave on the 22nd of October 1911,
which was then published in December in his journal, Seishun no Kenkyu, which is Biblical Studies, Studies of the Bible.
It was reprinted three times during his lifetime, and then again, I've missed that one, but in 1932, 2 years after his death, in the complete works. And then nothing happened. It just disappeared until 1946. And you can see also how the time he died, 1930, I mean, this coincides with, it's a dark valley period, you know, with the Manchurian incident, increasing militarization, and then it ends with the Pacific War, and then finally the end of the war. And then in 1946, it's republished, and it's been published almost every second year since then, until now. I mean, there have been 19, I've counted, in the Dyett Library reprints. And it came on the school curriculum from 1956. So it's a text that almost everybody who's gone to school in Japan since the 1950s has read. It's one of those, you know, classics somehow. That part of general post-war education. I don't know, Mr. Watanabe, did you read it in school? You don't remember. Okay. But we can say that this reception history, in a way, is a bit similar to another text that is often referred to, Fukuzawa Yukichi's Datsuaron, The Leaving Asia Thesis, which was written and published in 1885 and ignored. And then, sort of after 1945, it became, you know, it was considered a classic, a key text that was terribly important, but for a long time, I mean, and unlike The Story of Denmark, Fukuzawa's was ignored from the beginning until several decades later. That wasn't quite the case with this one. It sort of went up and then down and then very, very high up, you'd say. So it had this life from being a self-published, kind of eccentric, utopian, Christian dissident tract to an officially sanctioned part of general education.
And then I would say today it seems that the people who, if you go and look on the internet, for instance, in Japanese, you'll see that people are referring to it again, but now to say that, oh, look, Denmark does well without nuclear energy. We can do the same. He didn't write about nuclear energy at all, but the same thing. He was saying there's a utopia, there's a different possibility for Japan, and it's in Denmark. And that's that's happening again. And also about now with the debates about Article 9 and the Constitution. Again, that people are saying, oh, look, which is not, of course, not really accurate. It wasn't then. I mean, Uchimura's vision of Denmark wasn't historically very accurate, nor is it today. Denmark is a NATO country which has soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq, and, you know, it's by no means an unarmed, neutral, pacifist country. But the text, you know, has that life. So this is the first page of the text, where he starts by quoting the book of Isaiah, and then tells us how Denmark is a small country in Northern Europe. And if you can see it from here, and those of you who can read it, because this is old kanji too, but it's as he says, it's he compares it to Japan. You know, he says it's a small country. It's about this size of Hokkaido. It can fit into Kyushu, And so the frame of reference, really frame, is Japan. He places this strange little country inside Japan. So this is the size it is, right? It's and he presents it as a factual account of what happened in Denmark after the Second Schleswig War. This was when Austria and Prussia beat Denmark and took Schleswig and Holstein, Schleswig is today divided between North Denmark and Germany, the historical duchy, and I mean those areas, Holstein and Lauenburg and South Schleswig, which already then had German-speaking majority, are still in Germany today. And what he argues is that the country was ruined. It was in a terrible state, economically, morally down. But they managed somehow in 40 years to turn it around. And now in 1911, and I think he's probably right, I haven't actually confirmed that, but he says they have the highest per capita income in the world. How did that happen? That's what he wants to find out. How did that happen, and what lessons are there for Japan? He doesn't really tell us what his sources for this story is. It's a story of how he says, you know, they lost the war, and then there was a heroic figure, Ernesto Vargas, who was a Huguenot, who had been a soldier, an engineering officer in the war, and he came home and decided to plant trees in Jutland, which was wasteland, pretty much. This is about half the area of metropolitan Denmark, and it was underdeveloped. It had once, centuries before that, it had been forest that had been cut down, and nothing could grow there. So all he could do was keep sheep. And we can't really tell what his sources for that are, but I suspect that because he met Carl Skogo Peterson just a few months before that, they spent a week together, that's probably the main source, and also his friend Wilhelm Gundert, who was a German Japanologist. He was the head of the German East Asia Society, lived in Tokyo for, do you know about him, for many years, until the 1940s, I think, when he died. And he was a Nazi, so he became one. And also of sort of indirectly through reading of another figure who was quite prominent globally then, and including in Japan, Georg Brandes. We don't hear much about him today. He was a literature scholar, but his main work was called The Modern Breakthrough, and that was translated and also from German into Japanese, and was read widely. Harald Høfding, Danish philosopher, Kierkegaard Grundtvig, is another figure that Uchimura refers to a lot in his writings. And he was a theologian and sort of proponent and instigator of mass education, of kind of what they call literally folk high schools, universities for non-degree awarding residential universities where young farmers and etc. would go and study. So nothing like the University of Copenhagen, but you know, a good solid education for the masses. And so he probably read that, because Inoue wrote about Scandinavia because he visited Denmark and Sweden, and Mori Ogai is another early Japanese in Scandinavia and Germany who wrote about these things. He also, what he does refer to explicitly, and I think this is interesting, because mostly to the Bible, but also to East Asian classics like the Romance of the Three Kingdoms, very pejoratively to Mill and utilitarianism, to Mahan's Geopolitics, and quite approvingly to Schiller and Kierkegaard. Now, one thing that I found, one thing that the reason this caught my attention really was that exactly 100 years later, and I'm not going to go sort of a lot into that because it's still a bit speculative and I need to do a lot more work on this, but Francis Fukuyama, or Yoshihiro Francis Fukuyama as his real name is, wrote a book in 2011 called The Origins of Political Order. And I don't know if any of you know that book, but one of the catchphrases from that is getting to Denmark. And it's exactly the same, it's more or less the same argument and story in the same country that they're putting forward as kind of an abstract ideal of what every country should aspire to become like. And Fukuyama makes it quite clear that for him it's an Weberian ideal type. It's not really existing Denmark, but it's sort of some theoretical construct that shares a lot of what Denmark supposedly has of equality and well-functioning state and so on. So there are these striking parallels, and I think, you know, probably when you look at them, Uchimura and Fukuyama, although I think Fukuyama is not himself very aware of that, but, you know, when I saw this and started comparing, I thought, Fukuyama, yes, he's an American, he's a Japanese American, and he's a reformed Unitarian, you know, same theological tradition as Uchimura, and Uchimura knew Fukuyama's grandfather. They moved in pretty much the same circles around Doshisha University. They were both friends of Hiratsuka Raicho, and Kawakami Hajime was a colleague of Fukuyama's grandfather, Kawatashiro. It's just, there are some coincidences there, and it's interesting, but it's a little speculative at the moment. I need to look more into that, but I find it interesting. So, the hero of his story is Ernesto Delgas, who presents him as an ecologically aware patriot who saw, through his own experience, the futility of war and the virtue of what we call sustainable capitalist modernization. This is where sort of Uchimura's own experience with the mining industry in Japan comes in, because he had seen how destroying forest led to all kinds of disasters, and then he saw an example of how you could recreate forest and have all kinds of wonders as a result of that. So, and he contrasts him with, again, because the whole point of this is, of course, not to tell a story about Denmark, but to say something about Japan. That's what's going on. And he saw him as, you know, this great soldier, engineer, botanist, a visionary, and somebody who, although he was a soldier, mastered not only the art of killing, sort of implicitly meaning that, you know, the Japanese military elite, that's all they know is how to kill. They have no culture beyond that, which is interesting, again, when you consider that he's from a samurai family, that Bushido really informs his worldview, generally. And what he's also, sort of, one thing that he overlooks, and he probably didn't know a lot, is about Delgas. It's true, he was a Huguenot, and they were obviously a minority in Denmark. Uchimura forgets that when he paints this picture of Denmark as a tolerant state that's so wonderfully tolerant of religious minorities, that in fact it's also a theocracy like Japan. The head of state and head of church are the same. I don't know if he didn't know or if he just chooses to overlook that. But he looks at how, you know, it was a society that was open and welcomed these French refugees and gave them, you know, and allowed them to flourish. And what he also probably didn't know, that, as you can probably work out from his name, Ernesto. That's not a very Danish name. He was an Italian. of French Huguenot extraction with a Danish mother, who came to Denmark at the age of 7 when his father died. He was born in Naples and lived there until he was 7. So he was also an immigrant, because this is also part of what this text is about. It's also about, you know, if you read between the lines, and I think my reading is correct, it's also about how those Japanese citizens, given the fact, although he was opposed to imperialism, but given the fact that Japan was a colonial power, how should we deal with those Chinese and Koreans who don't follow Shinto? How do we, you know, how can we make them full members of the political community and not worship the emperor? So that's also what's lurking in the background here. This is a picture of Dalgas from the text, from the 1913 edition, and where, so he mostly contrasts Denmark with Japan and the British Empire and says, look, Japan is trying to become Britain. Don't do that. Become Denmark instead. You know, be small, be happy to be a small country. We can be prosperous, peaceful, we can trade, we can be tolerant of religious minorities and have the same impressive wealth, he thought. As he says, at that time, per capita income in Denmark was 10 times that of Japan and 5 times that of Britain and the US. So he's saying, and they're a small country. How is that possible? Why can't we do that? And that's what he wants to understand. And he says that, well, this is, I'm quoting him. By the way, yes. But sorry, just, I have, you have to look at this. I have a draft of information. So, and if you want, it's not, that is still unfinished. There's some typos and things I'm thinking about. But you can take that and read it later, or you can get it on my website too.
It's never been published in English?
No.
Kept it under threat.
No, So, as it says there, as a result of Dalgas' successful afforestation, the spirit of the Danes had completely turned around. Hope had been restored to the despairing, and after losing territory, they got a new and improved country. Moreover, they did this without taking anything from any other country. They rebuilt their own country. It was thanks to the zeal and patience that comes from freedom of religion and the mysterious power of big and small fir trees that they were able to recover their country from the storm. So that's how, you know, forestry and faith and freedom of religion can save a country. And then, having done that, so rhetorically, at this point, he moves on, this is on the last two or three pages, so he stops and tells his audience that, so what does this teach us? And he says that there are three lessons. One is, this is playing a bit around with John Dower's title, Embracing Defeat, which you can say is what Japan later went and did. That military defeat can be, and often is, a source of national regeneration. It's not the end of the world. He says there are hardly any countries that have ceased to exist, any cultures that have been wiped out just because the state lost a war. The culture continues, you know, it doesn't just disappear because you lose a war. And on the contrary, what Danish history teaches us is that, you know, you can mobilize the resources you have and you can do better. It can actually be an impetus for political change and progress, for improvement. And in that way, you know, losing a war means that you can win in the long run. And another quote here, his second lesson is that there's wealth to be found both on continents and on islands. The one who is lord of a continent is not necessarily wealthy. And of course, you know, he speaks about continents and islands. This is Japan and mainland Asia, about colonization. Nor is the owner of a small island necessarily poor. If developed well, a small island will also generate produce that is desired on the continent. The smallness of a country will thus never make it deprived. On the other hand, the great size of a country will never give it pride. So there's nothing colonialism is nothing to be proud of. It doesn't bring honor. And this is sort of where he gets very religious, is by sort of, and for him this is probably the most important, his last lesson, is that true power is spiritual, that a country's true power is not its army, not its warships, not gold or silver, but faith. And with regard to this, Colonel Mahon doesn't speak the truth, and Adam Smith and J.S. Mill do not speak the truth either. It's still the good old Bible which speaks the truth about this, he says. So this is, he continued to, so this is the final, the closing paragraph, where you see who this is addressed to. I mean, he says, who can claim that there's no relationship between religion, faith, and economy? Barty, you're teaching Max Weber. So it gets close to that, you know, religion, faith, and economy.
When was this, 1911?
11, yeah.
Was he reading Weber?
He could well have. Certainly some people were. I don't know if he was, but it's possible.
But it was like big news.
So he says, you know, that a country needs these well, I call it wise fools or intelligent idiots, but people who are willing to take these daring steps, and without it, you know, countries will perish, and that there's no greater danger for a state than mocking and devaluing faith. And finally, this is the last sentence, is that flippant and frivolous statesmen should take note. So he's speaking to the government. He's saying, this is, you know, take note of what I say and what I say about freedom of religion. And he continued with this theme. This wasn't the only time he wrote about it. He began in 1924, some years later. He formulated like this, that Denmark, by reducing her armament to the strength of a mere police, never thinks to have put herself in danger of losing her independence. Is now per capita the richest country in the world and essentially the strongest. So now is the time, and this second paragraph is very interesting. It's time for Japan to awake from sleep. This Western civilization, with its big budget for fighting machinery, is to be completely disowned. She is to start a new civilization, a warless civilization. Denmark on a bigger scale, an empire founded on the goodwill of the world, secure, industrious, peaceful nation, the leader of Christian Europe and America in the divine policy announced by God's prophet 26 centuries ago. So I think this is interesting because on the one hand, it reaches back, it shows a very Confucian way of thinking about the world as being organized around centers of civilization and peripheries of cultural prestige and power and leadership, international leadership by example. That Japan should become that kind of spiritual, if you like, great power. And so it sort of reaches back to some very old East Asian ways of thinking about world order, and I think also forward to the Kyoto School and ideas about universality and Japan's world historical mission. So he stands there, I think, between sort of ancient China and the Kyoto School, which also has elements of ancient China in it, you say. So finally, the afterlife, I think it's also worth noting that this was not something that was written completely in isolation. I think there's a wider tendency around that, the last turn of the century, the 19th, 20th century in Japan, to begin to look elsewhere beyond the US and the European great powers for models. And Scandinavia was one of the places some people looked to. And this is what he did. I mentioned Hjalte Reicho before, who you know, was very interested in Swedish feminism, Mori Orgai, who translated Andersen and travel in Scandinavia, interest in Ibsen and Strindberg's theatre, Grundtvig, Hans Christian Andersen. And so looking for a kind of more appealing, an alternative Western modernity to that they saw represented by the UK, US, France and Germany. And it was also, although he really didn't know what he was talking about, it was an early stimulus to later interest in Kierkegaard in Japan. I mean, he and Inoue were some of the first to mention, to write about him. And, you know, later people would, still in the 1930s, they're still working with German translations, but then one of, actually, Miki Kiyoshi's students, Masuda Keisaburo, learned Danish and did his own, you know, direct translations in the 50s. And so that's part of it. And we can also say that, you know, as I mentioned, it was sort of a text that that was probably quite widely read, or, you know, certainly reprinted a couple of times after its first publication, and then just disappeared for a long period, and then came back. And those people who brought it back and who were influenced by Uchimura were also people who, well, continued to think, but were not as persecuted as the Marxists, but certainly kept a very low profile in the 30s. Yanaihara, Nambara. Maruyama Masao was not a Christian, but we could say maybe we can speak of a kind of a liberal Tokyo school. Maybe I'm not. I shouldn't use the term school, but a group of people in Tokyo, many of whom were also Christians and who were liberal and who said very little in the 30s until 1946. They emerged and became very, very influential. So what we see, by way of conclusion with this text, is that it has both this originally utopian intent and then in a new context it could be read ideologically. It could be used, and it's been mobilized for both sort of purposes of systemic critique and of upholding sort of an existing order. So in the post-war period, it's been used to defend pacifism, developmentalism, mercantilism, and also from quite early on, there was a conference in 1950 dedicated to it to argue for Scandinavian-style welfare capitalism. And this is something that keeps happening. There's a guy called Chiba Tadao, who's actually, he's become a Danish citizen now, but he has written a number of books about the Danish welfare state, and is still active, and it's been used, not just this book, but this text, but others by Uchimura to argue for kind of progressive liberal education. The whole Tokai University system is not a very, well, it's reasonably big, but it's not very elite either. It's founded on Grundtvig's ideas, which came to the founder through Uchimura. And recently, I've seen people sort of referencing it when they write about energy policy and sustainable development, and that's where we are today. That it's kind of come full circle. This is not to say that the post-war order is completely over, but it's now being read in ways that are used for purposes similar to what was, you know, the original intention with it. And I'll end there. So please ask if you have anything. David.
When I was in university in Japan with your wife, ICU was a what is called Christian Koza. You had to be a Christian if you were a Japanese to teach there.
Mm.
And my professor was Otsukai Sao, the rather influential economic historian. And I had no idea, because he's Mukyokai.
Mm. Well, the whole university.
They were.
Yeah.
And Otsuka was the first serious translator of Max Weber.
Yes.
And so all of a sudden you've got all these links coming between a set of Christian ideas. The assumption that Christianity would make Japan's capitalism work better. That there was some relation between a Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism resonated powerfully in post-war Japan, because it implied, like Confucianism, a kind of moral discipline and direction. And this was fantastic. I mean, this exceeded the influence of Mukyokai by much, much, because Otsuka was a major figure at Toda.
Mm.
And the only reason he'd come to ICU is he retired, and of course, we welcomed him with open arms. If he went into his introduction to the social sciences, one quarter of the entire student population was in his classes.
Mm.
And he made not only Karl Marx, but mainly Max Weber, a byword. Everybody in my dormitory had a copy or had read. And also with Protestant thinkers, there were very few Protestants, let alone Christians, in the university, but everybody read. And so that may be one of the most important links between the influence of a set of explorations of religion and capitalism as allies that are non-Shinto,
yes,
but very Confucian. And this is remarkable. It's difficult to describe to you how important all these European writers were in a Japanese educational dormitory in the 1960s. There were more language translations from the West. You could reproduce the entire 19th century output of Europe in Japanese in a way that wasn't true in English. I mean, everything was translated and taken seriously, because, to put it modestly, they thought we invented the modern world, and they were determined to find out the essence of our secrets, much like Denmark. And the milieu that resulted was intellectually exciting to the very first order, because he walked in this dormitory and everybody knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was shocking. I mean, Marx read in German, for example, was considered not commonplace, but you respected the person who could. Mm-hmm. And so the influx of communist ideas and religious ideas and Endo Shusaku and on and on and on and on went. And I would guess, as I've written, that in 1968, when I arrived in Japan and walked into the center of Kanda, there were more bookstores there than any place on earth.
I think still today.
It's an astonishing kingdom of literacy, and which, as I said, to get Otsuka going on Max Weber and the difficulties of translating that, and how he thought the English text failed to respect the total context of Weberian thought, all of this happening in an undergraduate classroom in a small Japanese university on the margins of Tokyo. And it was a miracle in its own way.
And that's also why the Uchimura archives are now. I mean, they have.
Anyway, yes. Fascinating. Thank you very much.
Speaking of which, by the way, I just got very recently from sort of a leftover from the Japan Foundation Library in Madrid, Otsuka's translation of Economy and Society.
Right. That's a good job.
I have it at home now.
I mean, just to put it into this personal touch, Otsuka, my teacher, suffered a very bad disease as a young man and couldn't be conscripted, and he had to have double amputation during the war without anesthetic. And that strength of character, he said, it built him up. And he said, well, how did this show? And he said, well, I couldn't go to war, and I was in Kyoto, where he was from, and so I found out there was a key to the British Council's English language library. And I spent the entire war reading there. And I thought, yes, absolutely. But then.
Yes, sir. Just to continue on the theme you brought earlier of connection between religion and also economic systems, and you brought up as well the existence of Marx as well as capitalism. So I couldn't help but be reminded, maybe just a photo of his mustache, but of a clear connection between him and G.K. Chesterton.
Uh-huh.
And I see in this a certain drive towards a new kind of a political economic system that is not necessarily capitalism, but not necessarily anything on the left either.
He was very anti-socialist, one must say. He had very big problems and arguments with both Marxist and Buddhist socialists. He was for capitalism with a human face. I mean, if you like,
but a system that ultimately has its foundations in a higher form of a kind of religious Christian religious ethics, almost. That just struck me. I might be totally spitballing here, but what your thoughts might be on that.
Christian, yes, but it's a peculiar form of Japanese Christianity.
Yes.
I mean, he and some people, like there was another, I forgot his name now, but another figure of around the same period who was part of Mukyokai, but then said, well, went beyond that and says, this is no longer Christianity. It was quite also. What was his name? Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Post-Christian, but still Confucian. That's more or less what he was. I forgot his name, but
yes.
Graham.
Yes. I'm glad that you're somewhat Danish, because I think this is your project to regret, right?
Yes.
I hope you get it, because I think it would be a translation of this.
I've done a Danish and an English one.
With the supplements, later.
Yes.
And an essay by you.
Yes. I'm doing, basically, those of you who know me, this is my modus operandi. It's something I learned it from David. You take a text, you take the most important text, and you translate all of it. And then you comment, and you write, and you think, and you bring in other texts, all kinds of other texts, but also especially by the same person, and bring it all together. Yes. That's.
I think this would be really
good. Oh, good. I'm not sure, because I thought it was a bit of a digression, and it's kind of something that it just happened because last year was the 150th anniversary of Danish-Japanese diplomatic relations. And then they mentioned just on their website, oh yes, Uchimura Kanzo's book, it's just an article on Denmark. Nobody in Denmark knows anything about it, but it was just mentioned there, and I thought, well, let's have a look at that. And then I thought, this is like Fukuyama, you know, this is so, what's going on here? And then I found out that actually Fukuyama's grandfather knew him, that they were kind of moving in overlapping circles when Uchimura was editing a newspaper in Kyoto. Fukuyama's grandfather was in the economics department with Kawakami and Kawata, the grandfather, taught a course together at Doshisha Protestant University, very involved with the Ohara Research Foundation, which is Protestant, and he translated John Stuart Mill and was a friend of Hinatsuka Raicho, who was also, you know, Scandinavian. Not she wasn't Christian, was she?
No, not to my
knowledge. But Scandinavian influenced, inspired feminist, and hanging around with Protestants, certainly. Barty?
I thought you seconded this on the great project. although I would ask while I'm here. You said, if I understood you at the start, you say there are a lot of people who dismiss this as being uninteresting, or?
Yes, I think that was what I got quite excited about this. but then I also, as I mentioned, I was speaking to Prithilis about this, and I probably, that was a wrong choice of words. I said, he is quite unsophisticated as a writer and thinker. You're not really sure, you know, he's doesn't have the knowledge that some other people of his generation, and especially people who came later, had. He doesn't have. But then, as she rightly said, remember, he was an agronomist who started, you know, writing political theory and theology. That's you have to bear that in mind. He wasn't a trained philosopher, and he was very much an evangelist too. You know, he was trying to reach out to the masses, which he did very successfully, much more than many philosophers. Like Nishida, you know, never had the kind of public impact that he had.
I wonder if like in an introduction you do, if the real interest of the text, not so much the text itself, I don't know how interesting it is, but rather how it was taken up and what people did with it afterwards.
Yes.
That would be the...
And the interesting thing for me is also, I mean, is also liberalism and Christianity. Which is, I didn't get sort of very far with that today, but that I think, and this is, I think it's interesting that I've been thinking, never sort of, I've discussed it with David and Graham and some other people now and then, and with you, but not, never done much about it. But I think, and I see that something people like John Gray he's been on about it for years, and others, and recently, I mean just 2 weeks ago, you know, Cécile Laborde. The recent new book on liberalism's religion. I mean, it seems to be all the rage. I couldn't get a ticket to go and hear her at the Royal Irish Academy 2 weeks ago. They were sold out. So people, I'm interested, I've been for a long time, it seems everybody is now interested in liberalism and religion. But yes, I mean, that, what is the relationship between Christianity and liberalism? Yes?
It is something I'd like to mention regarding this, and what I find interesting, and I don't know the depth that you do because you have read it in the original sources, but something that's talking recently with some academics in Spain, in Zaragoza, we were talking about the attitude of Japan in the IR, the international relations context, versus other countries, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I see here is there's something of a cultural pattern, I think, historical as well. The idea that they try to have like a low-key position.
Mm-hmm.
There are other countries which go in bigger steps and they want to be seen big and take center stage of power.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, the Japan wants to have also power and main role, but it doesn't take this kind of big position, but is more subdued and humble. So it is part of what he said, okay, we have to be a self-reliant small country, that we would get big, but in another way, there wouldn't be a conflict around.
Mm-hmm.
So that reinforced that. And another issue which I find interesting is the interest in ecology,
mm-hmm.
which he has, which is also with many interesting also in Denmark,
mm-hmm.
as well, and that is somehow linked to Japanese culture as well, the idea of environment, care.
Graham?
Reminds me of a name I can't remember. The Austrian teacher of Schumacher, the Schumacher's group.
Oh, yes.
Do you know who that is?
Schumacher's teacher.
Yeah. Who wrote a book on. He wrote Small is Beautiful, more about politics than economics. And I was thinking also of a Lao Tzu, Mercedes Gustav, because this idea of gigantism, this Austrian author says, anything that gets that large is going to fail. You know, it's the size of it. And we need to be reminded now of small and beautiful.
Mm.
And this book does it. And yeah, you think about all the passages in the Lao Tzu that are addressed to small states.
Dao Zijing too. Anybody else, John? Yes.
What do you think was happening in Japan that prompted him to write in these terms in 1911? What did you see as
what had happened before that was obviously that the Russo-Japanese War, which he opposed strongly, I mean, and which he was very severely criticized for by mainstream opinion for taking a principled pacifist stance of that. And what else was happening was, I think what I read into it is, and where he sort of his reading of this his hero Dalgas as a member of a minority in still a majority Protestant country, but of a religious minority who was, you know, who had freedoms to worship and do as they pleased. I mean, this is very much to do with a conflict, I think, which is not only in Japan but really all over East Asia, a very problematic relationship between Christianity and the state and nation. About, you know, we see it in China today too, but that it gets problematic when people have a loyalty to something transcendent above the state. And I think what he's also, I mean, what he's talking about, as I mentioned, is also, although he wanted Japan not to have those colonies, but given that they were ruling Koreans and Chinese, well, how could they be fully Japanese if they were not, you know, if they didn't follow Shinto? So I think that those are the things. And another thing, of course, that goes back to his experience in the 1880s and 90s with the mining industry is this obsession with trees. That you have to keep the trees and respect the natural environment and make sure that nature, he says somewhere here, that nature is endlessly productive. You know, you just have to manage it well, and then it will provide a good livelihood for everybody. Yeah.